Newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, Play Radio Station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Monday, July 27th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by Grant. Good morning.
Good morning, Billy. Good morning, everyone. Now the reading of today's Boston Globe for this Monday morning, July 27th, 2026. And we begin here. Another pothole for those going electric. It's an article by Aaron Pressman of the Globe staff. Insurers are charging more or dropping EV policies. Ron Eastman got an unpleasant surprise from the insurance company that has provided coverage for his electric vehicle, a Polestar 2 sedan, and a previous electric hybrid for more than a decade. The 2023 Polestar vehicle does not meet company underwriting guidelines, the notice from the insurer Quincy Mutual said. This vehicle is electric and not eligible for coverage. A 76-year-old retired professor, Eastman said he's never before had an issue with Quincy Mutual, which is why I was very surprised when I got those letters. It's like, wow, what's going on? What's going on is that electric vehicles are often so much more expensive to repair than gas-powered cars that insurers are either charging significantly higher premiums or, in extreme cases, such as Eastman's, even dropping coverage altogether. This comes at a time when Massachusetts is already falling behind on its goal of persuading nearly 1 million drivers to switch from gas-powered cars to help cut climate emissions. Massachusetts has the highest difference in insurance costs between electric vehicles and gas-powered. 3,560 on average, for EVs in 2025 compared to 2,318 for gas-powered cars. This according to rankings from Insurify, which compares insurance rates. That's yet another hurdle to going electric after the Trump administration cut federal subsidies and automakers canceled or delayed some low-priced models. So says Lauren McDonald, chief analyst at EV advisory firm Cheganomics, and said that although higher insurance rates may be a minor annoyance for most people seriously considering an EV, they may end up being an added deterrent for those already concerned about driving range, reliability of charging, and other hurdles. With 171,000 EVs and plug-in hybrids on the road in Massachusetts, 12% more than a year ago, the reasons for the cost difference in the convoluted world of insurance rates are many. On average, EVs are newer and more valuable than gas-powered cars, 6 out of 7 EVs on the road in Massachusetts are 5 years old or less, while almost half of the gas-powered vehicles are more than 10 years old, and particularly for vehicles from EV-only brands, they can be more expensive to repair. On the other hand, EV owners typically get in fewer accidents and make fewer claims per mile driven than owners of gas cars, this according to an insurance industry study. But the rate is also notorious for its aggressive motorists. From the Koshkuko Circle of Hell Rotary in Dorchester to the narrow on-ramps of Route 3, Massachusetts, has more insurance claims per mile driven than any other state, this according to data from the insurance industry's Highway Loss Data Institute. So the risk of insuring a car here is higher for companies than in most other states. Also, there are fewer repair shops and mechanics certified to work on electric vehicles relative to the growing number of EVs in the state. There's always a lot of things going on, said Insurify economic analyst Julia Tallison, who is also a licensed insurance agent. When you have a lower repair capacity and a higher claim volume, that can contribute to a bigger gap in the cost of insuring an EV versus a gas-powered car. In addition to a driver's record, hometown, and other individual characteristics that insurers used to set rates, the value of a car is an important factor. For example, an insurer likely would charge more to cover a $44,000 Tesla Model 3 premium all-wheel driven sedan than a $28,000 Honda Civic Sport, other things being equal. And in a wealthy state like Massachusetts, we may have some higher value EVs on the road, fueling the insurance cost gap, Tallison said. Another issue driving the discrepancy is that high-tech safety features that rely on camera or radar sensors can be expensive to repair and require a specialist to recalibrate after replacement. Such features are ominous in EVs, but it's not in older gas-powered cars. At the same time, the safety features may help explain why EV drivers have fewer accidents. Tesla claims the semi-autonomous driving feature has 7 times fewer major and minor collisions than human drivers. However, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration escalated its investigation this year into possible safety defects in the feature. A 2023 insurance industry study compared national claims data for 11 types of EVs, though none were Teslas, to gas-powered vehicles over the prior decade. After adjusting for the number of miles driven, the EV contingent was involved in 19% fewer collision claims, but damages cost 2% more. For any individual driver, the number can come out in all kinds of ways. Software developer Mike Champion is paying $1,912 this year to cover a Polestar 2, an older Honda CRV. That's about $700 more than he paid before he leased the Polestar and drove a gas-powered Audi Q5. Champion, who lives in Newton, attributed the increase to the higher value of the new Polestar versus his older Audi. Louis de Jeffrey, a home inspector living in West Tisbury, pays $632 a year to insure an electric Mini Cooper versus $665 for a Volvo XC60 hybrid, even though the Volvo is the more expensive car. On the other hand, some new EV owners are finding their cars are less expensive to insure than their older, albeit flashier, gas vehicles. Craig Wiley and his wife saw their premiums drop by about three quarters when they bought a pair of Teslas, trading down from even more expensive luxury brands Audi and BMW. They now pay about $3,000 a year for the two cars. "For us, it's a non-story," said Wiley, a consultant in his mid-60s. "The car itself is cheaper, and thus this resulted in a lower cost for insurance. Insurers weigh how often particular car models get into accidents, as well as the cost of repairs. A basic Honda Civic, that model was involved in more accidents than all other models on average over the past 3 years. But the bill to repair those Civics was also well below average, according to the Highway Loss Data Institute. Meanwhile, a Tesla Model 3 AWD had nearly the same frequency of accidents, but is much more expensive to repair than the Civic. Taking both factors into account, insurers' losses were 24% above the average for all vehicles on the Civic, but 41% higher on the Tesla. The Polestar 2 that Eastman owns started at $53,000 for the 2023 base model and has a wide array of advanced safety features such as automatic emergency braking and lane centering assistance that can increase repair costs. Eastman feared Quincy Mutual was dropping coverage of all EVs based on the notice he received. But Andrew Green, assistant vice president for personal lines underwriting at Quincy Mutual, said that wasn't the case. "The wording on their notice should have been clearer," Green said. "We insure many EVs, but not every make and model under our underwriting guidelines." Green said the company's guidelines could rule out extremely expensive cars, cars with high repair costs, or cars with excessive performance. He declined to discuss any specific case, but said Quincy Mutual dropped Polestar because the Trump administration banned the company based in Sweden from selling new vehicles in the United States starting with the 2027 model year. That complicates repairs of the brand going forward, he said. "It doesn't make any sense," Eastman said. Polestar has told customers that they can continue to get service from Volvo, a sister brand. Both are owned by Chinese automaker Sili, he said. and the Trump administration hasn't penalized Volvo, he noted. Other insurers were less eager to discuss their EV policies. Among the top auto insurers in the state, Geico, Plymouth Rock, Arbella, and Travelers did not respond to requests for comment. Liberty Mutual and Farmers Insurance referred questions to the industry-backed Insurance Information Institute. Progressive referred questions to other industry groups. A spokesperson for the Institute, Loretta Wordes, said that while EVs remain more expensive to insure on average, the gap appears to be narrowing for newer vehicles. As the EV market matures, repair networks expand, replacement parts become more available, and insurers accumulate more claims data. Pricing is likely to become more refined. In the end, Eastman got comparable coverage from Plymouth Rock. The auto policy for 2 years cost $2,000 a year, about the same as his old policy. Other EV owners are saving money in more unusual ways. Chris Souza, 42, who lives in Attleboro, said he has been so impressed with the semi-autonomous driving mode in his Tesla Model 3 after using it to drive more than 100,000 miles that he dropped collision coverage from his auto insurance policy, saving about $1,000 a year. Souza will have to pay for repairs on his Tesla if an accident is his fault, but he is undeterred. I trust the software enough that I suspect I won't be in any major collisions. That article again by Aaron Pressman of the Globe staff. Also from today's Boston Globe, we have these stories under the Nation's section. New tariffs claim forced labor without proof. Trump imposes double-digit taxes on 60 countries. This article is written by Mae Anderson of the Associated Press. It's datelined New York. The Trump administration has imposed double-digit tariffs on more than 60 countries using a legal justification that permits the president to levy import taxes and other sanctions against countries found to engage in unjustifiable, unreasonable, and discriminatory trade practices. The new tariffs announced in recent days take effect just as temporary 10% worldwide tariffs expired, and critics say they are less about cracking down on forced labor than they are a way to replace those tariffs. The expired tariffs were themselves a temporary replacement for the worldwide tariffs the Supreme Court struck down in February. The tariffs were leveled on countries that the United States says either don't have or don't effectively enforce a forced labor import ban. The affected countries, which account for 99% of U.S. imports, were quick to protest, calling the Trump administration's claims unfounded and arbitrary, as nations with vastly different records on forced labor received the same tariff level. The United States spent 4 months investigating but gave few details on how it arrived at the tariff rates, which are either 10% or 12.5%. The tariffs were levied under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974 on countries that the United States determined had failed to impose and effectively enforce a prohibition on the importation of goods produced with forced labor. During President Trump's first term, he cited Section 301 to impose sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports amid a dispute over the sharp-elbowed tactics Beijing was using to challenge America's technological dominance. The United States is also using the same tactic to counter what it calls unfair Chinese practices in the shipbuilding industry. The 301s allow a permanent tariff without going to Congress to settle the dispute, said Barry Appleton, a law professor and co-director of New York Law School's Center for International Law. That's what all of this is about. The president doesn't want to knock on the front door of Congress, so he's trying every side door and every unlatched window to get in. The Office of the United States Trade Representative said it consulted with all 60 economies under investigation and held two rounds of public hearings, elicited more than 2,100 public comments, and had engagement with its trading partners about what they were doing to combat forced labor bans. It didn't detail the talks with the countries, saying those were confidential. Experts say it is fairly straightforward to investigate whether a country has a ban or not, but it is difficult to determine the government's exact rationale for each country's failures to enforce import bans. There's not a lot of hard evidence there, said Scott Lindecombe, Vice President for General Economics and Trade Policy at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. It's pretty laughable on its face to think that a country like the ones in Europe or in Norway or Switzerland aren't doing enough to police forced labor. And even if countries do enact and enforce the forced labor import bans, the United States wants, they would still need to prove that they're enforcing them in Washington, to Washington's satisfaction, and before the tariffs would be removed, said lawyer Patrick Childress, a partner at Holland and Knight and a former U.S. trade official. This suggests that no short-term path, the countrywide relief from the new Section 301 tariffs will be available, he said. Many countries have pushed back against the Trump administration's findings. Brazil, which faces a 12.5% forced labor tariff, called the U.S. move arbitrary and unjustified. The United States chose to manipulate an issue of greater importance to human rights and the struggles of workers worldwide in order to accuse 59 countries and the European Union of unfair practices, it said in a statement. Also, from today's Boston Globe, we have this story from the nation's pages. As Trump boosts nuclear power, a deregulation push, radiation rules could be eased to help expansion. This article is by Jennifer McDermott of the Associated Press. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is proposing to eliminate a foundational safety principle that has for 50 years minimized the radiation people in the United States are exposed to, and that has been adopted around the world. Currently, facilities such as nuclear plants, hospitals, or academic institutions that the radioactive materials must ensure radiation exposure are kept as low as reasonably achievable. The ALARA principle. The NRC proposal would abandon that philosophy while keeping a separate standard on maximum radiation exposure. The two standards have worked together in radiation safety. Dose limits set the maximum amount of radiation the public and radiation workers can be exposed to, while the ALARA kept radiation exposure as low as practical under those limits. Research shows radiation exposure increases a person's chance of getting cancer, a risk that increases as the dose increases. The dose limits are not changing, but the NRC, which regulates civilian nuclear energy technologies and radioactive materials, now wants to replace ALARA with a graded approach that includes several actions facilities must take depending on the potential dose of radiation to workers. Most rigorous radiation protection in those measures would be required when approaching dose limits to ensure they aren't exceeded. This comes as President Trump attempts to quadruple domestic nuclear energy production because of surging electricity demand amid a data center and artificial intelligence boom. Reforming the NRC is one way Trump is trying to speed up nuclear reactor development. He instructed the federal agency in an executive order last year to adopt science-based radiation limits. The Energy Department, which oversees national energy policies, has already stopped using ALARA. The NRC expects to finalize its radiation protection regulations in the coming months. NRC Chairman Ho Ni said the commission is not lowering the bar on safety. We're just removing the ambiguity, he said in a call with reporters. But the standard for exposure to workers and the public, those are not changing. We've just putting in place greater clarification. Ni doesn't expect major changes within the nation's existing fleet of large traditional reactors, but companies designing and building new, smaller reactors could move faster with a cleaner picture a clearer picture of how the radiation protection requirements will be put in place, he said. The NRC said radiation exposure limits are set well below levels associated with health effects, and it expects remaining standards and industry practices to keep radiation doses far below the limits. There's incentive to do so. It's more expensive and time-consuming to work in areas with higher radiation because access must be restricted and more surveys are required. The Nuclear Industries Trade Association agrees with the NRC. We will always continue to look at what we can do to reduce the dose to workers and maintain our doses to the off-site public as low as possible, said Doug True, chief nuclear officer at the Nuclear Energy Institute. It's not like we're just going to throw open the doors and let everything run up to the limits. ALERA, that policy, created a moving target for regulation, said Justin Friedman, a nuclear energy consultant who previously spent three decades at the Department of State. Getting rid of the rule would allow NRC scientists to make more rational decisions about appropriate levels of manageable risk, he added. Edward Lyman, director of nuclear power at the Union of Concerned Scientists, cautions that some parts of the NRC proposal could raise permissible radiation doses in certain cases, while still staying below the cap. Iman highlighted a proposed revision to radionuclide emission standards in particular. Radiation exposures to the general public is limited to 100 million parts per year. A typical dose of radiation from a chest X-ray is 10 millirem. The NRC wants to increase its radionuclide emissions standards from a conservative 10 millirem per year to 25 millirem per year, based on a hypothetical person living in a house at the property line for a nuclear plant. The NRC says actual doses to the private would remain lower because, in reality, people live farther from nuclear sites and benefit from dispersion in air and water. Also, from today's Globe, turning to the world pages, we have this: U.S.-Iran pause attacks after escalation. Energy supplies, economy hang in the balance. It's an article by Sami Magdi and Kara Anna of the Associated Press. This particular article is datelined Cairo. The United States and Iran paused their attacks for a second straight day Sunday as efforts continued to bring them back to negotiations on an interim ceasefire deal, largely undermined by recent exchanges of fire. It was not clear why the United States has paused after targeting Iranian coastal areas and infrastructure in a nearly two-week escalation sparked by Iran's firing at ships trying to transit the Strait of Hormuz. The Pentagon did not respond to questions. President Trump is giving talk some space, he said. He's giving it a little bit of room, Mike Waltz, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, told Fox News. We've had both Oman and Iran and a number of other negotiators engaged at every level, from the most senior level all the way down to the technical level over the past few weeks, and particularly in the past few days. Waltz dismissed the idea that the U.S. stockpile of interceptors crucial in defending against Iranian attacks is running low, but experts have questioned how long both the United States and Iran can afford to keep up attacks. Since the United States has halted attacks for the past two nights, Iran has as well, its army spokesman told the press. Excuse me. Iran's state TV Sunday said in Iran, Tehran in recent days has counterattacked against countries in the region hosting U.S. military forces, killing at least three service members at a base in Jordan and one in Iraq. The 60-day period that had begun when the interim deal was signed by both countries in mid-June is now well into the second half, and major issues that were meant to be negotiated, notably Iran's nuclear program at the heart of tensions, remain set aside as mediators try to keep both sides talking. A regional official involved in mediation efforts said diplomacy was underway and a pause in U.S. and Iranian strikes was a positive signal that helps their efforts to de-escalate. The official said both countries want to return to the interim ceasefire deal and a compromise being negotiated centers on having Iran run vessel transit through the Strait of Hormuz with fewer restrictions on ships. The official was not authorized to discuss the matter and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Concerns continued about shipping on the strait and now on another crucial waterway in the region, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait to the Red Sea. Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen last week threatened a blockade of Saudi shipping there. Global energy supplies and the economy remain in the balance as gasoline prices have risen again. Commercial shipping traffic on the Strait of Hormuz was at a three-week low, a maritime body overseen by the U.S. Navy said Sunday, adding that no new attacks had been confirmed in the past 72 hours. It said traffic remained steady through the Bab el-Mandeb. Iran said Sunday it continued to speak with Oman about managing the safe passage of ships on the Strait of Hormuz, which passes between these two countries. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson, Ismail Baghaei, said talks had made progress and they also continued. Baghaei also said the strait's status remained unchanged. Tehran has asserted that the interim deal with the United States allows it to manage shipping on the waterway for now. and it has objected to U.S. efforts to support a route through the strait that passes close to Oman instead. The strait was considered an international waterway before the war. The U.S. military said Saturday it recently reimposed naval blockade against Iran continued, with a dozen commercial ships redirected, two disabled and two boarded. U.S. forces remain highly vigilant, focused, lethal, and ready, it said in the statement. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu plans to travel to the United States and meet with Trump in Washington Tuesday, his office has said. They last met in Washington in February, weeks before they launched the war on Iran that killed senior leaders, including Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Netanyahu told Fox News on Sunday he fully backs Trump's efforts to weaken Iran and press it to end the nuclear program it has. Next, from the World Pages, we have this piece. File it under News Analysis. It's by David Sanger of the New York Times. In today's Boston Globe, the headline, Trump seems trapped by war, needs to find face-saving exit. And this article, opinion piece, News Analysis, is by David Sanger, as I said, and is datelined out of Washington. President Trump often celebrates his unpredictability, declaring that it keeps allies and adversaries alike off balance. But his telling, his willingness to bomb Iranian nuclear sites 13 months ago and send Delta Force commander in to snatch President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela from his bedroom early January reflected his determination to execute military operations that would have made his predecessors blanch. He told the New York Times he was limited only by his own morality as he wielded the world's biggest hammer. But in recent weeks, he has seemed trapped, his presidency gradually consumed by a war he cannot find his way out of. He has discovered limits of his power and that he could have scarcely imagined as he began full combat operations on February 28th when he set out goals for a swift end to Iran's nuclear program and the overthrow of the country's government. 5 months later, those goals remain almost entirely unaccomplished, and Trump, once confident that overwhelming force would enable him to pursue in Iran what he proudly called the Venezuela model, a change of government to one amenable to U.S. control, is now hesitant to plunge back into major combat operations that his intelligence agencies assess are unlikely to work as well in Tehran. He has been unable to control surging oil prices or their effect on the stock market. The shipping that crawled to a stop in the Strait of Hormuz, then was opened for a few short weeks, is back to a trickle, with a second choke point between the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, now threatened as well. And while the president has threatened to take Karg Island, where Iran ships oil, or to seize the underground stores of enriched uranium. He has said publicly that he knows there is no appetite for sending in ground troops. Not all of Trump's frustrations, people close to the president say, are driven by the war. Now so unpopular that only 29% of Americans polled by the Washington Post and Ipsos approved of the handling of the conflict. But much of it is, and the angst is clear, as he promises to stop Iran's nuclear program at any cost, while his allies at home want out. Excuse me again, I apologize. We've got to wrap it up, Speaker Mike Johnson said last week, voicing a sentiment heard increasingly from Trump's most enthusiastic supporters. But the president does not have a clear way to accomplish that goal, having entered the conflict with little strategy for victory. He is now struggling for a face-saving way to exit. A month ago, he exuded confidence that he had found the way to declare victory. On June 17th, Trump signed with a flourish at the Palace of Versailles, where World War I officially ended in 1919, a hastily written 14-point ceasefire agreement. It lasted only 2 weeks. Now Trump has three main options: military escalation, economic crackdown, or declaring victory and getting out. Each has been debated in recent weeks in meetings with Vice President J.D. Vance, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his special envoy, Steve Witkoff. Each option seems unpalatable for different reasons. The third option is to declare victory and go home. But exiting comes with costs. It would define his legacy. Turning now to the daily briefing section of today's Boston Globe, we have these stories. This out of Washington: court upholds halt on mail voting order. An appeals court has upheld a lower court ruling blocking key parts of an executive order from President Trump to restrict voting by mail, the latest setback to his efforts to wrest control over elections as Republicans try to protect slim congressional majorities in an unfriendly political environment. In a 20-page ruling on Saturday, the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals wrote that Trump's order directs unprecedented levels of involvement by federal officials in how states administer elections. If the order took effect in the midterm elections this November, it would sow confusion and threaten disenfranchisement of many eligible voters, the court ruled. The Constitution grants authority over elections to the states in Congress, not to the executive branch. But Trump has waged a years-long campaign against voting by mail, signing executive orders, supporting court challenges, and promoting legislation to curtail the option, which the president himself uses. Courts have blocked many of these attempts. The ruling comes after more than 20 Democratic attorneys, 20 Democratic attorney generals challenged an executive order Trump signed in March targeting mail voting. Also, we have these stories from the daily briefing section of today's World. This, two dead in Ukraine from Russian attack. Russian ballistic missiles struck the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv early on Sunday, setting off fires and wounding at least three civilians, while attacks on other parts of the country later killed at least two people, local officials said. The strikes came as Ukraine's successful drone attacks have stalled the Russian army's advancements in an expanded campaign inside Russia that has been causing fuel shortages and piling pressure on Russian leader Vladimir Putin. In Russian-occupied eastern Ukraine, Kremlin-installed authorities said a Ukrainian drone strike had killed four civilians in the city of Hovrika. This according to the Ivan Pershiko, the city's Russian-appointed mayor. The city had been under fire since the early hours of Saturday. According to Russia's defense ministry, Russian forces overnight struck down 133 Ukrainian drones over Russia, the Black Sea, and the Crimea, the peninsula that Moscow forcibly annexed from Ukraine in 2014. Blasts rocked Kyiv in the early hours of Sunday, with falling debris sparking a blaze in a tower block near the historic center. This according to Mayor Vitaly Klitschko. Elsewhere in the city, falling debris set fire to buildings, cars, and car parks, Klitschko added. He said three people had been wounded, with one needing hospital treatment. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky warned in his evening address on Friday that the intelligence assessment, indicated that Russia was preparing missiles for a large attack, saying there were indications that this could happen in the next 48 hours. Russia's defense ministry claimed on Sunday its latest attack on Kyiv had struck sites linked to drone production. Also Sunday, a drone strike on Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city in the east, killed one person and wounded at least six others, including two children, the mayor there, Igor Terekhov, reported. Also, this story, a suspect in Berlin Pride attack killed in confrontation. The suspect in the deadly Berlin Pride attack in Germany that left one person dead and 29 injured was shot and killed by police during a confrontation on Sunday in a suburb of the city, authorities said. Abdul Balint, a German citizen with Lebanese roots, was killed following a search that lasted nearly 24 hours after the attack in downtown Berlin. Prosecutors said he had previously sought to join the militant Islamic State group. Balut was suspected of driving a van into a crowd near Berlin's Pride Festival Saturday night before apparently stabbing others with a machete in what authorities believe was an Islamic extremist terror attack. Interior Minister Alexander Dobrindt said the attack occurred a few hundred yards from a party near the Brandenburg Gate that was supposed to close out the city's Pride Festival. Balut was tracked down around 6 p.m. on Sunday at a garden in Spandau, a Berlin suburb, in which the city's police department wrote on X. Let's look at the globe for this Monday morning. Also briefly, with the weather forecast, forecasters say it's going to be a cool week overall for late July, early August. Temperatures flirting with 80, but also in the upper 70s. And then we're going to see some clouds head our way tomorrow, later in the day. And then into Wednesday, we could see periods of heavy rain. The words flash flooding have appeared yet again in the forecast. So take heed in that regard. Finally, quickly with the sports, the Red Sox finished their 9-game homestand with a 6-1 victory over the Toronto Blue Jays on Sunday. They now head west to take on the Athletics, playing those games out in beautiful Sacramento, California. That's it. Enjoy the week, and thank you for your ongoing support of the Talking Information Center. Hopefully, we'll catch up real soon. Take care.
These are the death notices for Monday, July 27th, of Boston, Francis Xavier Frank Kelleher, Will Sebastian Metzinger, Dr. Richard Neil Woolman, of Falmouth, Francis Xavier Frank Kelleher, of Milton, Will Sebastian Metzinger, of Plainville, James Chauncey Smith, of Walpole, James Chauncey Smith, and of West Roxbury, Francis Xavier Frank Kelleher. This concludes the death notices for Monday, July 27th.
Loved one owns a gun, and for a while now, you've been concerned about their behavior. They're just not acting like themselves. They've been distant. They've been unpredictable. They've been lashing out. They've been saying things that make you worried they might harm themselves or friends or family. Or you're worried this loved one might hurt you. Maybe they recently threatened someone with their gun. You know something needs to be done, and you wish more than anything you could hit pause on this situation. Well, here in Illinois, you can, with a firearm restraining order. In extreme cases, this order temporarily prevents a person in crisis from having a firearm, giving them time to heal before they do something dangerous or even deadly. If you are worried about a loved one in crisis who has access to a firearm, learn more about firearm restraining orders at illinois.gov/pause-to-heal. A public service announcement brought to you by the Illinois Department of Public Health, Brady, and the Ad Council.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. I came out in the 11th grade. Nobody was embracing you. The kids were cruel. It was very difficult to be gay. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
The hard part was determining that I was going to do it, but I definitely didn't do it alone.
At age 30, with the help of her mentor, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
I have a mentor, Maria. She convinced me to continue my education and finish what I started to get my diploma. Just never judges. She's a true role model. If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, go get it. You can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?